Keys, Installment 1. The Decentralization of Information and Communication. Mathematical Word Problem. Part 1. The date is January 1st, 1990, and you are one of the richest people on the entire planet. You realize that the only thing missing from your extravagant lifestyle is having at your fingertips the near totality of all information and knowledge compiled throughout human history. So, you set out to build the most comprehensive library of information that anyone has ever seen.
Your library will include books of fiction, but also books on the topic of philosophy, ethics, economics, history, politics, social science, cooking, badminton, the arts, knitting, chemistry. You know what? As a matter of fact, it's just going to have to include a bunch of books on any subject that anybody could possibly be interested in. You're also going to want to have a pretty comprehensive multimedia section that includes documentaries, film clips, television news clips, photography, audio for speeches, lectures, debates, music. And to ensure that it is always the world's most comprehensive library of information, you'll need to have access to a variety of news sources to constantly be updating the library with new information. So this will include newspapers from all over the world, but also magazines on any subject that anyone, again, could possibly be interested in. You're also going to have to hire, oh boy, a whole bunch of people who can continuously be providing technical support, advice, and guidance on any of the subjects that anyone could find in your library. And considering the scope of information that these people will have to cover, you should also assume that you're going to need to spend several years and whatever resources are necessary traveling around the entire world assembling this team. You're also going to need to devise some kind of complex and elaborate, but at the same time easy-to-use cataloging system so that all of the information in your library is searchable by anybody who wants to verify that it is indeed the world's most comprehensive. You're also going to need to think about some kind of a building where all this information could be kept. And again, you do all this with the goal of having the near totality of information and knowledge gathered throughout human history at your fingertips. As you plan this project, keep an expense report. Be sure to include the costs of the material, as well as travel, staffing, shipping, maintenance, and storage. In addition to establishing a total cost for building this library, also calculate what percentage of the project would be complete when one of the richest people in the world, in 1990, would realize that they were bankrupt. Part 2. The date is January 1st, 2010. You are a jobless high school student. Repeat the exercise in Part 1 with the goal of discovering, in money and resources, what is the cost to you. Christmas. So, Merry Christmas. I made you this podcast. This is a new type of installment to the show that I've decided to call Keys. Now, if you've been listening all along, at this point you're probably familiar with three types of installments. The first are the numbered episodes that usually deal with some kind of, dare I say, lesson about the state or its education system. The second type, supplementals, will include interviews that I do on somebody else's show, maybe an appearance on somebody else's show, hopefully in the future, they will include debates once I can find a public school teacher who wants to debate on the issue of government education, and any other conversations that are relevant to education or to the pursuit of liberty will also be classified under supplemental. The third type of episode, which starts with the title School Sucks, are just looser, less structured announcements or anything that's, for whatever reason, I feel is worth putting into the feed. And hopefully those in the past and in the future are tolerable. So this is the fourth type, which I, like I said, have decided to call Keys. On my website, it says, imagine a door to complete personal freedom, abounding opportunity, and greater personal satisfaction. And public education, I believe, is essentially the lock on that door. This is a show about finding the key, or the keys, the paths to solutions. I don't claim to have any kind of ready-made solutions or replacements for the problem of public education. But there's such a myriad of projects and ideas that could work independently or together to educate people in lieu of a government-run, coercively funded public school system. And many of you might be familiar, many of you who have been at this for a while are probably used to having conversations with political people, people who believe that there are socially acceptable ways of using theft and violence, who will, if you said, I want to get rid of the government education, they would say, well, what are you going to put in its place? How are you going to do it? How are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? I don't know. I'm not a central planner, so I wouldn't claim, I'm not frigging insane enough to claim that I have a one-size-fits-all solution for hundreds of millions of people in perpetuity as far as education goes. And one of the favorite questions of apologists is, what about the poor? How would you educate the poor? Well, while there are so many ways that this could be done, and so many things that haven't even been thought of yet, I'm not the person to answer that question, because I don't really have a personal incentive to make sure that all the poor people in the country are educated. Nobody does. In fact, maybe the only person who has less of an incentive are middle-class bureaucrats who get a raise no matter what happens to the poor, like the people who work at the Department of Education. But that's another subject, and we will deal with that, trust me. And let me say this, too. Even though I say that I lack a personal incentive to see that all poor people in the country, we'll say, receive an education, that doesn't mean that I don't have a desire to see people who are less fortunate or people who live in the inner cities get some kind of enlightenment in their lives. But of course, what's happening now is they're being gathered into central locations in these inner cities that gangs can use for recruitment and drug sales. And you'd have to be pretty imaginative to argue that that is education. It might need to be 10,000 different things that go in the place of the government-run school system. And this series is about pointing some of those things out. Now, the first one is a no-brainer. This is obvious. In the last 15 years, we have witnessed the most exciting and just an incredibly beneficial period of technological advancement in the way we get information, the ease with which we can get information, and in the ways we communicate. And it's been a very exciting time to watch this happen. I worry often that people who are younger, people who might be half my age, you know, 15 or 16, have never known anything else, and there's a tendency to take this time that we're living in for granted a little bit. So I thought it was worth doing a show about starting to discuss the impact of this technological revolution that we're living in. And throughout history, I think it's important to point out that information was very centralized. It was very controlled, and people didn't have easy access to the knowledge of the ages or from different parts of the world. But today we do, and it's easy, and it's basically free. And this is just an amazing, amazing development. If you talk with people who are older, they'll often reminisce nostalgically about the old days or the golden age, and you might want to ask them when the hell that was. Because the best time, in my opinion, to be alive is today. Now, earlier tonight, I was having a conversation with a 21-year-old cousin of mine who's kind of reached a point in his life where He's having some problems. He wants to be a filmmaker. He's really talented, really smart kid. But he's stuck in community college, and he feels like he's lost direction. And he said to me that he used to have a close group of friends, but they all moved away, and they would make movies together. And, you know, he sort of lost the drive to do that since these friends disappeared. So I started talking to him about the resources that he has. And the resources, because I remember being that age and being interested in things and not having these resources, that I was worried, and it turned out that I was right, that somebody 10 years younger than me might be taking them for granted. So the first site we started talking about was Facebook. And my goal was to help him find ways of connecting with people who were like-minded or had similar interests. Because what I've found, and maybe you know what I'm talking about, when you're really passionate about something or when you really want to do something, if you surround yourself with people who are not interested in that, like if you want to really take chances, if you want to start your own business, and you're surrounding yourself with 9-to-5 employees who are like, oh, you know, these are my benefits. I get paid on Friday. I got a cat calendar in my cubicle. My 401k looks good. You know, the enthusiasm for taking risks is going to be sucked out of you. And this has happened to me, too, as somebody who's never really been into the idea, or at least for the last few years, of having like a 9-to-5 stable job, having a boss. So when I talk to people who might be in conditions where, or in a place where they have a lot of economic stability, they're very certain about their plans for the future, if I surrounded myself with people like that, there would be a tendency for me, even for me, to question my path. So I think that somebody who's 21 and maybe a little bit, you know, kind of coming out of school relatively recently and still in college, might be less sure of their dreams, their goals, their desires than somebody who's had a little bit more time to shake off the lessons of school. So we start talking about Facebook, and I'm really just this Facebook pitch man in this conversation. Now, when I started using Facebook, I think I signed up for an account within the last year. I didn't understand how it worked at all. So I started getting these friend requests from people that I went to high school with or college with that I would describe as kind of awkward semi-acquaintances. And I guess the draw for them to me was that we had attended the same school. So they wanted to be my friend. And these were people like in high school. If we were the only two people in a hallway, and we were walking towards each other and about to pass each other, we might exchange a kind of an awkward, hello, hey there, but not really any kind of relationship. So I started getting friend request after friend request of people like this from high school and college. And as some time went on, I realized that what I had been entering into were these virtual one-way pen pal relationships. And it wasn't like pen pals in the old days where you might get a letter from your pen pal every 3 or 4 months and it's like, the winter was cold, but now it's spring and you were getting outside again. It's like every 15 minutes. I'm watching Dancing with the Stars. I just ordered Chinese food. I'm updating my Facebook status. Here's a picture of my kids watching Shrek. Here's a picture of my kids on Halloween. Here's a picture of my kids watching me update my Facebook status. Thank God today's Friday. And then 2 days later, it's like, I hate Mondays. And it was just completely overwhelming. But what I figured out that I could do is that I could block updates from these people. And as I started to find more like-minded people on Facebook, or they found me, people who were involved in the Free State Project or Free Domain, and we became friends, I could get just updates from like 25 or 30 people that were always posting really interesting things in the newsfeed. And over time, what Facebook became to me was like an online newspaper written for me, updated constantly. And it's become an amazing resource. I originally, when I started doing School Sucks podcast, I thought maybe that I could get like 50 shows out of the whole thing. But just from what I've seen people post with links and videos, I have enough material to prep another 50 shows after that now. So I really think that it's been an incredible resource. And I was talking about it with my cousin that he should start looking into Facebook groups. And I mean, he lives in Massachusetts, right? So Massachusetts has kind of become a hub for filmmaking. And there's got to be 1,000 people within a 100-mile radius of him who have similar goals. And relationships with those people might help motivate him. And we also started talking about meetup groups and maybe even some resources on Craigslist. And this was like new information. I mean, we always think about how there's this generational thing with technology. Like, we know how older people feel about technology. They're terrified of it. They don't think the internet is reliable. And then, you know, our generation tends to be pretty tech savvy, but we think this next generation is going to even exceed us. But because people my age, I would say between, like, you know, 30 and 40, remember very clearly the time when none of this stuff exists, we realize the importance of not taking these things for granted, something that somebody 10 years younger might not realize. So it was a really educational conversation for both of us. But, you know, during the entire exchange on this specific subject, because we talked about a lot of things, we actually had a really great time today, I kept looking at my nephew, who's less than 1 year old, and thinking, you know, here I am talking to this 21-year-old, excited and almost envious of the resources that he had access to or has access to at such a pivotal time in his life. And if all goes well, what is this little man going to be able to use? What is he going to be able to do? It was a neat moment. So I wanted to talk about that, and it's just I might not have a lot of powerful stuff to say about it, I just can't get over what an exciting time it is. But what I realize is that not everybody everywhere is on board with this.
Many times in the past few years, I've worked with students on research projects that they have to do for school, and I'm always shocked but never surprised by the reaction that I get when I ask the question, have you gone to Wikipedia? Because the response is always, we're not allowed to use Wikipedia. Like, Wikipedia is like a porn site in high school. You're not allowed to go there because anybody can edit it. And a few times I pointed out to kids that, guess what? Anybody can become a teacher in your high school. It's not the cream of the crop that picks that job, just so you know. But in the future, and I don't want to talk about this too much, because in the future on this show, there will be an episode entitled The War on Wikipedia. But as I pointed out to kids what a valuable resource Wikipedia is, like, I say to them, you wouldn't get in your car and try to get to a destination if finishing the project is the destination, without a map. You'd at least want to look at a map of where you're going if you were unfamiliar with the roads and you had never been to the destination before. So Wikipedia essentially gives you a map of a topic. And then once you're done with the map, there's all kinds of linkable references that you can use to make your work easier. You can find the things that were used to create this compendium of knowledge on a subject, and then you can use those things as reference. But see, school isn't about working smarter. School's always about working harder, like coal miners do, right? It's not about working smarter like business people do. So what's even more horrific is that recently, kids have been telling me, a couple kids at least, that they're not allowed to use Google. They're not allowed to search on Google for information for their research project. If you ever went to college or graduate school, you're probably familiar with databases like ERIC or EBSCOhost, which is just this collection of scholarly journal articles on, you know, education or psychology that the school grants you exclusive access to, and the school has to pay for a subscription. Well, they make these kinds of databases for government high schools as well. And it kind of is like this little area of the internet is roped off for the kids to use. They cannot search for their topic, for sources for their topic, using Google, which absolutely amazes me. That this entire world, this huge spectrum of information on any given subject, is blocked. and these pre-approved sites of aggregated journal articles for high school kids is their limit. It's really sad.
But I think that example fits in quite well with a lot of the things that I've been discussing regarding government education. So let's move on to talking about some solutions, some potential alternatives. And today I wanted to bring two gentlemen on the show who I believe are involved in a very exciting project. The reason why I wanted to do an entire show interviewing them about what they're doing, well, there's actually a number of reasons. The first is that I met them in person and we had a nice discussion and I was really impressed with some of the things they had going on. Number two, because their site is still in the early stages of development, and it will always be in development. I mean, as long as this project goes on, it will be developing. It's called alekheeds.com. But while it's in its initial or early stages of development, considering that I probably have a lot of people in the audience who are pretty tech-savvy already, to avoid dealing with information that most people are already aware of, I thought that doing an interview with the two guys who are building this website, alekheeds.com, this educational resource, would be newsworthy. And three, and this one's kind of it's a little bold, but I think that this site has the potential to be so revolutionary that I'm going to try to call it on School Sucks Podcast. So maybe 2 years from now, when this site is revolutionizing the way education is being done in this country and around the world, you heard it here first, or some of you heard it here first, about alekheeds.com. And just as a little transition here, the advertising campaign on Free Talk Live that Jason Osborne put together was quite successful as far as bringing new audience members to the show. So thanks to Jason again for doing that. But the ads that appeared on the show were read on the air, but not knowing that initially, I went ahead and cut like 15, 30-second ads as promos for School Sucks Podcast. And now, and the guys did a great job of reading the ads on the air, and they had some really nice things to say about the show. But now I have all these little 30-second spots that I don't know what to do with. So I thought I would just kind of work them into the show where they fit, just so they are heard. Otherwise, they're just going to get deleted, and it's actually a little bit of work to put together a 30-second advertisement. So I thought I would play them. Thanks again to Jason Osborne for doing that. He's involved in a lot of liberty-oriented media projects, including Free Talk Live, Liberty Conspiracy, and a couple of others. So hopefully I'll have something new and exciting to plug for him soon in exchange for his pledge of continuous support to School Sucks Podcast. So I'll play that little ad and then the interview with Alec Muller and Daniel Royer from alekheeds.com. Thanks for listening.
Critical thinking question. Why would something that's so good for us, like public education, need to be imposed on us with force and funded with force? What are we, like a bunch of helpless idiots who wouldn't know what's good for us unless it jumped up and kidnapped us for 12 years while using stolen money to teach us to worship authority and fit ourselves into predictable and easily manageable groups?
School Sucks Podcast, a show about the end of public education. Visit schoolsucksproject.com to learn more.
I am being joined by Daniel Royer and Alec Muller, the creators of the website alekheeds.com. I was going to turn it over to you guys first to explain to the people listening what alekheeds.com is and what's different about it.
Daniel, want to take this one?
So Alekheeds is basically a website to help people learn various skills at their own pace, in a decentralized manner, and to help connect them with tutors who like to tutor those skills, and potential employers who are looking for people knowledgeable in those skills. And so we do that by allowing our users to create lesson plans, which are basically lists of skills in a prerequisite relationship, and they can create add links to tutorials or videos or other how-to content on the website. And so a user will go through the lesson plan and look at each of the skills and tutorials and links, and attempt to learn the skill. and other users can come along and test them and verify that they do in fact know the skill for any potential student who is looking for a tutor, say, or for a employer who is looking for a an employee.
So I guess just to have a frame of reference, we have a website that everyone is familiar with, Wikipedia, which is another example of a website that is semi-collaborative and aggregates a tremendous amount of information. But it sounds like what you guys are saying is more – what you're saying that you're adding is more of a live collaboration feature in addition to a system of reputation rating. And that the, obviously the architecture of the two sites is very different. Alakiz is more visual. It has an entirely different interface. But if you had to, just to use that frame of reference, is that accurate what I'm saying?
Well, Alakiz and Wikipedia have two different goals. And in fact, they work together in many ways. Wikipedia is designed to have articles about the various topics. But it's not really designed to help teach its users about those various topics or about a larger topic. For example, if you wanted to learn, say, how to program in a certain programming language, you could go to Wikipedia and look up that programming language, but it's going to give you, you know, history about the developers of the language and, you know, all of this programming jargon that if you're new to programming, it won't help you. So what Alakiz does is it will break up the task of learning a programming language into various steps. You know, first you need to learn what a variable is, and then you need to learn what a function is, and so on and so forth. And then you need to learn how to do variables and functions in this particular language. And so it helps break it up and guide the user step by step through each of the tasks. And it remembers what you learn so that if you go on, you want to learn one language, you learn all the basics of programming, and then you want to learn another language, you don't have to go through all the basics again, because Alakiz remembers that you already learned that, and so you can start right at the as high as you can go, and it'll help save you time so you can learn more skills quickly.
I see, and when we had talked before, you know, I from our conversation, I got the sense that both of you guys are interested in ultimately positioning this site as an alternative to traditional methods of schooling. So one of the first questions I would have is, how can two people, let's say the person who's in the role of a student and the person who's in the role of a mentor, effectively collaborate on Alakiz together? How does that work?
There are a variety of possibilities, and at this point we are still in what's called the alpha phase of development, where we are actively seeking feedback from people who are doing exactly what you're talking about. And we have a couple of people who regularly help us by adding content and using the site in various ways to let us know what works and what doesn't work. For example, one of the tools that we have, I was telling you about the lesson plans. Well, we call those trees on Alakiz because they look like trees. And we use that metaphor throughout the site. For example, each skill is a leaf on the tree. And if the skill is brown, that means it doesn't have any good links. And if it's green, it means it's good, and so on and so forth. And a tutor, a tutor and a student, the student is going through the tree. He can check off what he knows and what he's learning and where he's going. And the tutor can watch the student in real time doing that, using a feature what we call remote viewing, where you can view a tree as if you are logged in as somebody else. And so the tutor can look at what the student is doing and test the student and even verify that the student does, in fact, know the skill that he claims to know. And we're looking at a variety of other tools and technologies that we can either create on Alakiz or tie in to Alakiz. For example, Skype. Skype is a good way for people to remotely collaborate. Students and teachers can talk about the various subjects. And you can record your conversations on Skype so you can put them online so other people who are trying to learn the same subject, who may be encountering similar stumbling blocks, can come along, and the tutor doesn't have to repeat himself. And once again, that helps accelerate the pace of learning for students so they can gather employment skills faster.
And is it safe to say that if somebody is in the role of a student, once they on the site can show that they have mastery over a skill that they were learning, I assume that they can pretty much turn around and have the on-site credentials to start teaching it to somebody else. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
So it keeps building and building like that. And effectively over time, it would seem like you would have more and more educators or mentors or tutors, potentially working on the site.
Well, one of the things that already exists are websites for computer geeks to rate other computer geeks in various technologies. So we just kind of are taking that idea and generalizing it a little bit. So yeah, you know, certainly if you're working on a project team that is developing a new technology, like say you're part of the Google Wave development team, and you can create a tree or various lesson plans about how to use Google Wave. And of course, as the developer, you're going to know how to use it in a pretty intimate sort of way. So you can, you know, check off that you know it, and the other people on the development team, you can verify that they know it. And then when other people start learning it, you know, you can test them or however you want to do it, verify that they know the skills. And then it's very laissez-faire. You don't have to, be verified to be a tutor or anything, but, it improves your marketability because whenever you search for tutors on the site, it says who is verified and who is not verified. And obviously somebody who's verified by, people who are well known in the particular area are going to be more attractive to somebody who's shopping around for a tutor than a tutor who is not verified.
So we also essentially are introducing competition and consumer choice into this learning process.
For education, that's weird, isn't it?
It's very alien, very bizarre.
Well, it was an interesting idea that Alec had one time about starting a school. And I think this was before you actually tried to start a school and realized just how much red tape there is. And the idea was to kind of have more of a salon private school where the teachers rent classroom and equipment from the school, and the parents pay the teachers directly. So the teachers are very close to accountable to the students, whereas in current school models, the teachers are paid for by the school, and the parents pay the school if it's a private school, or the government pays the school in most cases. And so there's really not that direct incentive of you teach the student well or your paycheck goes down. But there is way too much red tape to start an actual brick and mortar school. So until that happens, we thought that using that decentralized learning concept on a website, which has far less red tape, would be a good testing bed for the various technologies.
Alec, can you tell me a little bit about that experience of trying to start a school? Because I actually had a similar venture years and years ago that was never able to get off the ground. But what happened to you?
Well, let me say that Alec Ease is indeed a direct descendant of the original idea that I had for trying to start a school, and that the school that I actually ended up working with friends on starting this past September is very much separate from that. So it's a whole different set of hurdles and obstacles. But basically what we've encountered in trying to start the school is that zoning is a nightmare, and trying to find a central location that you can afford and that has all the features you're looking for is a nightmare, and trying to find enough teachers that you can actually afford to pay and enough students that are willing to pay the money. It's very complicated, very quick.
Now, is the idea, I mean, as far as the model or the philosophy that would be incorporated into the school, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The school actually has a very unique model in that it is an emergent curriculum-based school. And there are essentially seven students ranging in age from about 6 to 11, and they basically learn whatever they want to learn about, and the teachers are there to help them identify sources for these things and go out and learn them. So it's very much different from the top-down approach that you'd have in a conventional school. Alec Ease has kind of taken its own different turn, because I realized that the things that are possible on the web are so much more exciting and powerful than the things that would have been possible in a brick and mortar school that there's really no sense worrying about the limitations of brick and mortar schools at all anymore. And just trying to look at a totally new way of transferring knowledge from one person to another.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. And from there, if I could ask both of you, in the best case scenario, as this project grows over the next 5 years, what do you see or what do you imagine or what do you hope for as far as the impact of the site is concerned? And even if you could project a little bit beyond, let's say, 5 years, how do you see sites or ideas or projects like Alec-Hees giving traditional models or government schooling sort of run for its money, if you will?
Well, I see it as an amazingly powerful opportunity for people to bypass those systems altogether, because they can go directly from the people who know something to the people who are learning something. And that's the biggest thing that I think it has to offer. The part that I'm most worried about, and or not worried about, but the problems Daniel and I are trying to solve are figuring out how to get all the monetary incentives to work so that people can benefit by creating this content and so that others can benefit by using it.
So you're saying that there would be, in the best case scenarios, ways to actually make money from being a contributor or being an educator or a participant on the site. How would that work?
Well, at the moment, we've incorporated basic advertisements through Google AdSense in the site, and we've already promised 75% of our advertising revenue to the people who contribute the best content to the site, and we have an internal mechanism for measuring what that is, and it's both the quality and the quantity that people use that content. And I think that has some promise, but I think the thing that has more promise is targeted advertising, so that when you're looking at a tree, you can see ads that are targeted for people who are trying to learn a particular thing, which from a tutor's standpoint, that's an ideal target audience to advertise to, because you can say, I tutor this particular set of skills, you're trying to learn them, why don't you come talk to me and I'll get you through the parts that really need one-on-one interaction and can't just be learned from reading a tutorial.
Just from there, in addition to quantity, what would be the marks, just as I'm trying to create a sort of fuller and more vivid picture for the people who are listening to this about what Alec-Hees is and how Alec-Hees is an example of how the new channels of information and communication, well, they're not really new anymore, but I mean, they're always new. There's always something new happening, but how these new mediums can be used to get that picture. What are the marks? What are the attributes of somebody who is contributing high quality content to Alec-Hees?
Well, the best mark is that it's content that people actually look at, meaning they found a particular link to an article or a YouTube video or to any other kind of content, and they've actually followed that link and looked at the content, and then that they've gone back to the site and checked off a skill as having been learned. Because basically it doesn't do much good if you have links to something that doesn't actually teach the content. And we want the website to keep tabs of that. So basically we use the skill checkoffs both to tell the users what they know and don't know, or for them to keep track of what they know and don't know, but also to identify individual links as being something that helps them learn it or something that isn't as good as the other options for that. And a part of the decentralized information that's a big part of our philosophy is that you can have many different ways of learning the same skill, and we want them all to compete with each other and for the best to come up to the top.
So obviously we're not, this is not breaking news when we're talking about the decentralization of communication and information, but for both of you guys kind of working as programmers, as web designers, can you speak a little bit about the impact of what's really happened in the last decade? Because I think a lot of listeners to the show might be too young to really remember a time when information was less accessible. we're old enough to remember just wanting to know something and not being able to go and find it out in a matter of minutes. But a lot of younger members of the audience might not have a sense of that. So from your experience and the work that you guys have done, what have the last 10 or 15 years meant to the world as far as communicating with other people and sharing and gaining information is concerned?
Well, it's interesting because it seems like in the past 10, 15 years, there's been a trend towards making information more accessible. And what I mean is that originally you had, for example, music was sold with digital rights management, DRM. And now you can actually buy music without that because people don't like having those restrictions, and those restrictions, they don't allow you to use the music in certain ways and so on and so forth. So the companies have realized that if they start selling that stuff without, then people will be more likely to buy it as opposed to just downloading it. And you also have things like Google Books, where they've been digitizing all books that they can, except, I guess, for French books, because the French government just slapped them with some kind of fine for doing so. But now, if you want to find a book about a particular topic, you can search in that Google Books, and they'll show you a variety of books that are related to your topic. You know, and I found a number of books that through that I wouldn't have known about otherwise. And you have a lot of things like that where you have to mark up the data to describe what it is. You know, MP3s have the ID3 tag, and videos have all their interesting tags. And I remember just recently I was out of the country and I didn't have access to the internet. And there were so many things that I would come across, places I would visit, or just in conversation, something would come up. And it was like, oh, I want to know more about that. But I didn't have access to the internet, so I couldn't Google it, or I couldn't read the Wikipedia article about it. So, and the people around me didn't know anything about it. So I basically just wrote it down, and I had to wait, you know, several days until I got home to look it up. And by that point, the excitement for the topic had kind of diminished because you're not in the middle of everything. And so now, you know, I was out shopping the other day and I found some interesting stuff, in a bookstore, and I wanted to find more information about the author because I had heard about the author, and I was just able to whip out my phone right there and look up more information. And it was just so nice because it's like, I don't even need to use my brain anymore, you know? So. Information has gotten a lot more accessible, and there does seem to be a trend that way. A lot of, for example, image file formats in the early days of the internet were mostly GIF files, and GIF files file format was patented, I believe, and so you couldn't make GIF files, at least not legally, without paying royalties to whoever made the. I don't think it was GIF. I think it was the compression algorithm. But either way, so that fostered the creation of PNG images. And so now there's a lot of images are in the PNG format, although I think GIF has recently come out of their patent, so it's not much of an issue anymore. And so that trend seems to be increasing and improving because there's very little consumer pressure or public pressure to, you know, bring back DRM or make things less accessible.
If I might interject for a moment, Dan. One of the things that I'm most excited about with the web and making information easier to share with each other is the evolution and how that's different than it was before. Because you can mash up other people's content and make improvements and share those improvements so much more easily now than you could before. So it makes the creation of things that couldn't have existed before much faster. So that's the thing that I'm most excited about and something that we make good use of on Alkies.
Well, I think, you know, it's really interesting, too, that Daniel mentioned music, and we really do, it seems, today live in an age of push marketing, and more people in the music industry are starting to realize this, that there's nothing magical about owning an LP or a cassette or a CD anymore. They are realizing that the conditions are such now that if they want to continue to make money in that industry, they have to adapt to what's going on, that CDs are essentially worthless. They need to put content out for free and then try to make money in concerts or with some other you know, some other product. Obviously, merchandising is huge for bands. Box sets are still a good way that bands are able to move CDs. But the other place where we see a lot of this push marketing is in the software community, and as far as open source is concerned, and it's also the place in the last 10 years where we've seen probably the most innovation, because in a lot of cases we don't have to deal with IP issues. Nobody is, or you know, far fewer people are putting things out and saying, "This is mine. You can't touch it. You can't do anything. There's a patent. This is trademarked." I remember the first time I saw, I'm sure you guys are familiar with OpenOffice, which is basically an open source version, essentially, of Microsoft Office for free online. So I think that there has to be a correlation between the laissez-faire approach to what's going on in the software community and the amount of innovation that's occurred there in the last decade.
Well, yeah, isn't it odd how I used to work at a hospital, and programs that the surgeons and the doctors use to figure out which drugs that you've been given and what allergies you have was written by a company that you know, had minimal, if any, licensing by the government. The programmers, they might have had a college degree, but you can't bank on that. And yet, you know, the surgeons and the doctors themselves had to go through 150 years of school each to be able to operate on you. But they're relying on the software. And there's so much innovation in software and hardware. And it's continuing at phenomenal rates, exponential rates, because there is no or very little regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike, say, schooling, where there's a tremendous amount of regulation, and we're still using the 1850s model.
Yeah, indeed. Absolutely. That, I've said it many times on the show before, school is very much based on a model that was designed to make young people into compliant factory workers, people who could sit still, who could perform simple tasks, who could follow basic directions, and who were predictable and manageable as a large labor force. So here we are 150 years later. Those economic needs, even though they might have existed at the time in an industrial and manufacturing society, have completely vanished from the 21st century. But the schooling still follows the same exact model. Children sit in desks. They perform simple tasks. They learn basic skills. I mean, if you think about the things that most people retain from their 12 years of education, it is, it's factory labor skills, basic reading, basic writing, basic math, conformity and compliance. So, I think that's that is one of the best examples of a place where there is absolutely no innovation because of course of the very heavy regulation, but also because there's a complete lack of incentives to deliver anything innovative or anything of quality in that field.
And innovation is actually punished in many cases.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I'm sure some people are familiar with. There was a movie about this math teacher. I think it was called Stand and Deliver, and it was a true story, and I think it took place in inner city Los Angeles, and the teacher's name was Jaime Escalante, and I think he goes into this inner city school that's just wrought with gang violence and every sort of inner city horror that you can imagine, and he goes in as a substitute to work with these remedial classes. And in a matter of time, he's able to get these kids active and interested and excited about math, of all things. And as the story progresses, I think they actually wind up competing in math competitions. Now, obviously, this is not like super root striking what Escalante did, because he's still doing it, you know, in public school. It's still like, you know, you come to this room, you sit here and you listen to me. So it's not ultimately where we want to take education. But in the example of what happens to people who are innovative, or what happens to people who raise the bar, well, Escalante was ultimately pushed out by the union, because taking remedial math students and bringing them to a place where they can compete in math competitions raises the bar a little bit too high for the comfort of a lot of the people that the union protects. So absolutely, innovation or any kind of moving forward or creativity is punished. I talked in a recent show about the young teacher, the guy who's in his first 5 or 6 years of teaching, how enthusiastic and hopeful he is about what he can do as an educator. But go back and visit with that guy 15 or 20 years later, and he's somebody else. The system has erased that optimism out of the teacher, because they've realized that those goals are completely unrealistic in that environment.
And again, it all goes back to the incentive structure you have, and the incentive structure that goes with a state-funded institution is going to be completely different from the incentive structure you have with private tutors.
And I've talked about that in the past as well. I mean, if imagine how effective I would be at providing a service if every time that I completely failed to deliver the service that had been agreed upon with any level of quality, my response to the person who I had made the contract with was, well, you know, the problem is I just need more money. I just need more money. I just need more hours with your kid, and I need to charge you more because we're not getting it done at this cost. Which is basically what public education does. Not many private service providers could stay in business doing that.
Well, it's interesting talking about incentives, because there was a TED Talk recently where they actually looked at incentives and in creativity, and they discovered that for creative tasks, the very best incentives are ones that are internalized, which is why high technology companies like Google actually allow their employees one day each week that they're required to work on something that that they're passionate about, that they can experiment with, and that gets them, you know, thinking in new and creative ways. It's not money, and it's not, you know, job security or benefits or anything that motivates modern workers. Cash, you know, motivates people to you know, put a sprocket on a widget, but it doesn't motivate people to think of new ways to make the particular widget. But that's what public school does, is it designs, it causes people to be, it trains people to be motivated by, you know, getting a pat on the head. And then those people go out into the workforce, and they work in corporations where they, you know, they get punished for innovation, and then they move up the ranks in the ladder. And they start punishing other people for innovating. So you really do have to internalize the motivation. And you were talking in one of your recent podcasts about how you have to, when you're tutoring students, you have to slip in this real learning amid the teaching that goes on to develop a passion, to foster a passion among the learner to actually learn something, because that's the only time that real learning is going to take place, is when they're passionate about it.
I used to describe it, and I would hesitate to use these words now, but when I first started to realize what my function should be, it was kind of like tricking the student into wanting to learn, because they're so resistant to the idea, and it's not really anything I can do. It's just like trying to create that environment where something sparks their interest. And I always found that whenever I was being successful, if I'm sitting to the left of the student and we're having this great success and they're really getting energized about something, if in an imaginary scenario, the teacher of whatever class for whatever subject we're working on was sitting to the right of that student, they would be like, what the hell are you guys doing? You're way off track. You're never going to get this thing done if you just keep jibber-jabbering about whatever has got Johnny all excited here. You got to get back to doing your work, because this is work. You know what I mean? So you're absolutely right. And that is a model that prepares people to put sprockets on widgets for to get a paycheck on Friday. So with absolutely no enthusiasm, with no drive, with no innovative spirit. And, you know, I think what's really exciting when I look back at my education, I spent like 18 years in formal schooling between 12 years of government school and then, you know, 4 years undergrad and 2 years grad school. The bill to me for the last 6 years was about $60,000. The bill to the taxpayers and my parents is immeasurable. And I mean, if you want to apply like an actual dollar amount to every useful thing that I got out of those 12 years, the cost is just staggering as far as, the actual value is concerned. But in the last 3 years, and really, really, really in the last year and a half, everything that defines me as an educator or as a thinker or in many ways as a human being was from information that I got online virtually for free. That it's all out there for free. And I think that speaks to how really, truly boundless the opportunity is in, you know, the situation that we live in today. And I really hope that young people don't take this for granted.
When you talked about the cost of your public education, those 12 years or more, what immediately struck me is not just the cost that the taxpayer was paying, but the lost opportunity cost, not just for you, but for everybody, in terms of what people would have been capable of and the potential that was lost due to all that wasted time.
Yeah, it really is when you think about how much time that takes, how many hours of your life, not just spent being forced into that building Monday through Friday, but all of the hours that, you know, are peripheral to that, doing homework or studying. And it can be a 50-hour-a-week commitment for some kids. And you're right about the opportunity, because it's not just the time that it's taking up, but it's also the energy and the enthusiasm that it's draining out of them at the time in their life when they're most curious. And they're most, in a lot of ways, I believe, more creative and more optimistic, because they haven't grown up into that world of imposed limitations yet. They still know how much is possible, and they haven't been conditioned to believe that basically nothing is possible except you graduate from high school, you go to college, and then you get a job, and that's what's possible for people. Right? Like when we're younger, we think we can do anything. And you're right that opportunity is just smothered by the experience of going to school and everything that comes with it. So yeah, I think that's a really good point.
But on a more upbeat note, I guess, I'm really excited about all the things that we're seeing in the last 5 and 10 years. And I try not to worry too much about how smothering an experience it was, because I don't think it's going to last. I think that people are slowly realizing just how useless it is, and the technology is there and it's being used to create the alternatives that will actually overtake it.
Yeah, and to speak, I hesitate to speak generally about such things, but if you think about what people our age from our generation have realized and have become aware of, that at the same time, people of our parents' generation who are still living, who are still, involved in seeking information, even if only for the purpose of reinforcing the belief systems that they're so comfortable with, fail to see, they fail to understand. And it's really, I think, I kind of feel like it's almost the first time in history where the younger generation has really, really been able to effectively challenge and question the older generation. I mean, for so long in history, it was just like the older people pass on their wisdom to the younger people, which is why we still deal with all these forms of mysticism and religion, because older people know and younger people are there to basically absorb their quote unquote wisdom. But now I've really seen it in my own interactions and in a lot of the interactions with of other people that I've spoken to about the subject, that we can challenge the people who have always been seen historically as the wisdom providers. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think it has a lot to do with who knows these things that are authoritative, believable, that have evolved to become believable. If you look at the old model in handing it down from generation to generation, that's going to have one set of constraints that kind of affected that evolution. And then you look at the new model with everyone sharing everything online and with a very fast turnaround for changes, and it's still an evolutionary system. It's just so much faster. And the people who are going to be plugged into this are going to have the powerful ideas. And those are the ones they're going to be listened to.
Mm. And, you know, I think that this is really, I definitely share your optimism. And what I was building off, comparing our generation to our parents' generation is what I really hope and what I really believe will be possible for the next generation, who are kids who are coming up through school right now, who have never known anything other than these conveniences and this massive decentralization of information and communication that we all live with today. And I just want to be really, really, extra clear about not taking that for granted, that it's so valuable. And it still is, I think, in a way new to us, even though that it's been going on for more than a decade. This is such a great, great time of opportunity that Daniel, what was that you were saying before we started about you were comparing the internet to the printing press?
Just looking at examples from history about the decentralization of information, the printing press is an example, and same thing with the translation of the Bible. That completely yanked the rug out from under the feet of the church, and you have the Protestant Reformation. And if you look at, the Protestant church, it's got like a gazillion different denominations, and that's because it's designed to be, it arose out of this idea of decentralizing information. And it's like all of a sudden, for the first time in history, there is no monopoly, no state monopoly on information. It's like the Federalist Papers and Common Sense and all that kind of stuff, written by just ordinary people who can have it printed. And granted, it was expensive at the time, but it was possible for an ordinary person to do that. And and you saw a dramatic change in society, and that was kind of where I don't know if that's you're the history teacher. You could tell me if that was around the time of the Enlightenment, or it was around the time. I don't remember if it was before or after.
Yeah, but, I mean that's really an innovation that pushed the Enlightenment forward for sure. Absolutely.
You can see one thing. You were talking about how knowledge is passed down from generation to generation. Well, I think what happens, and this is just my opinion. I really don't think there's any way to prove it, but a lot of people just don't know that there are other people who think like they do. Or, so if you are living in, say, 1850s America, where it's, and you're living in a small community and everybody goes to church, and you're sitting there in the pew thinking, this whole church thing just doesn't sound right, but there's nobody else in the community and you can't bring it up because you're going to get, flogged or something, or mistaken for a witch. Whereas nowadays, you type this stuff online and there are a gazillion websites of people who think just like you do. And so you're not alone. You're not weird or some kind of apostate or something. And so you can kind of connect with these people and have reinforcements, and you can, share war stories, as it were, and things like that. And combine that with the fact that for the past, I think it's like 60 years, there has been a measurable increase in intelligence among each generation. Something like 12 IQ points. Each generation is smarter than the last. And so, you can actually, and given the access of information nowadays, you can say that each generation is the smartest group of humans that have ever existed. And that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that you touched on there was throughout time, if a person was incredibly curious, or they had questions about the convention of whatever society, the conventions of whatever society or community they were living in, they were isolated. They were alone. And I think the family is certainly, in many ways, a microcosm of that church community that you were talking about, that, the family has its traditions and the family has its values and its beliefs, and you gain acceptance into the family by, you know, taking on that same belief system, doing what dad did and doing what mom and dad, or believing what mom and dad believed. I remember in my own life, like 3 years ago, when I started to discuss some of the questions and some of the ideas that I had with my family, the reaction was really, it was a mix of just ridicule and outrage that if I had not, quickly realized that I was not alone, that these questions were valid, that a lot of the conclusions that I was coming to made sense, far more sense than any sort of the mysticism that they were passing off as truth, then I don't know. I might not have ever moved forward. I might have retreated from that curiosity and from that questioning of convention, if I had not been able to connect with like-minded people. And ever since I did, and ever since I've been able to build a sort of new community of friends and people to interact with, I've really, really, just the difference in my ability to engage people on these issues that are so controversial has just dramatically improved. And I just feel so much more comfortable doing it now, and so much more self-assured.
Well, I certainly don't want to denigrate any past generations, because the place that they were coming from, every small incremental step that, you know, one or two people were just dragging humanity forward, kicking and screaming, and they were ostracized and they were executed for having these ideas. And even, you go back to like tribal times, the punishment in, for example, the Old Testament, which lists all of the laws that the tribes of Israel had to follow, a lot of the punishments were being outcast from the tribe. And at that point in time, being outcast into the wilderness was essentially a death sentence. And I believe you've covered this before, or something similar. And so if you stand up and start talking out against the secular rulers of the tribe, or against the storytellers of the tribe that give the secular rulers their power, they're going to start, pointing their fingers at you. And that's not something you wanted to have happen, because you weren't going to be able to, just drive on over to the, next door tribe and join them. You were going to be, cast out into the wilderness where there are ugly snakes and giant cats who want to eat you. And, but nowadays you don't have to worry about that kind of thing. Yeah. You get, your current, circle of friends will ridicule you or something, but it's not a death sentence. Although certainly that fear has kind of been bred into us, because the people who survived in the past in those tribes were the conformists, and there's really nothing shameful about that. But it is something that we have to recognize. And you were talking about how the family is a microcosm of the tribe and of the state, and it seems, I would go further and say that the state is a reflection of the family, just because, it seems like you have two kinds of states. You have, fascist, goose stepping, let's go invade all these countries state, which would be kind of like paternal. That's why you get, Germany was the fatherland and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then you have the, softer, guilt people. We need welfare to help the poor, and we need healthcare to help the poor, and the blah, blah, blah. And that would be more like communism, and you had Russia, which was the mother world. And so it definitely seems that there's a reflection going on there.
Yeah, I do think I did actually talk about that in an earlier episode, the paternal versus maternal authoritarianism, but it's all authoritarianism. And it's a very good point. And another thing that you said that I just wanted to jump back to for a minute, I think that is very true, that it's important to not denigrate past generations, because it really wasn't like people in history just marched along for thousands of years in exactly the same way and exactly at the same pace, and then Gen X came along and just blew everybody's mind. I think that there's always an attribute of young people to question the conventions of the society that they're being raised in. I think certainly the people of our parents' generation were doing it in the 1950s and the 1960s, for sure, in big ways. The results were obviously mixed, but I think that this is something that's always gone on through time. I don't think that anyone, the attitude has never really been, three more years until retirement and then I'm going to change the world. It's always young people who are pushing humanity forward. Like you said, sometimes it's very small groups, and they're doing it with people kicking and screaming behind them. But what I think is worth pointing out is that now the ease and at which it can be done, and the opportunities that exist to do it, are unprecedented. There's nothing to compare it to in the past, and I think that that's one of the most exciting things about this topic of the decentralization of information and the decentralization and the ease now of communication.
That's true. Although I think that the translation of the Bible into vulgar language was revolutionary. You know, just the first time in history, people, the common person, able to sit down and read the Bible for himself and say, "Hey, wait a minute, it doesn't say this, or it does say this, but it says, you know, this other thing over here," and you know, it completely revolutionized, it was a radical departure in history, and you have all of these new religions or denominations spring up, and certainly the internet is threatening to do that with everything. Take that translation of the Bible writ large, every subject. You know, no longer do you have to rely on the filtered news from the mainstream media. You can go out and watch it being happened for yourself, recorded from 30 cell phone cameras, and make your own opinions and talk to other people who are there or who, you know, don't have, aren't filtered by, you know, big corporations and government and so forth.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a couple of places where that's really exciting are in the areas of political philosophy and economics, because it was a small group of people that you know, throughout most of even the 20th century, who made it to higher education, where they would then encounter professors who had a very clear agenda to kind of you know, pass the torch to this next generation, who would basically inherit the same ideas that they had inherited, and to keep that project essentially moving forward. Now, just like it once was with the Bible, maybe in the Enlightenment, all of those conventions are being called into question, and I think that that's really a pretty recent development as far as scale is concerned, but it's very exciting to see where that will go.
Oh, I agree, definitely.
I'd even go so far as to say that we really haven't even begun to see the big impacts that this is making. The stage is really set, but the play hasn't started.
Yeah, exactly. I absolutely agree. I really think that we're just at the beginning, and I really hope that young people can realize the powerful tools that they have at their disposal that were pretty much absent through all of history, with the exception of the last decade or so. And it will be very exciting to see what transpires in the next 10 years.
Tools like alecease.com.
Daniel Royer and Alec Muller are the creators of alecease.com. Visit their website to check out what they're doing there. It is very exciting, and it's always, I'm guessing, guys, it's expanding on a pretty regular basis.
Exponentially.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate both of you taking the time to join me, and hopefully we'll do it again in the future.
Brett, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Take care.